You're listening to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB. Practical know-how to help your farm business.
Hello, and welcome to the AHDB Food and Farming Podcast. I'm Katie Evans, a Senior Knowledge Exchange Manager on the Beef and Lamb team. And today's podcast is about looking ahead and planning for 2023. With a focus on grazing and the benefits of outwintering on fodder beet. My guests today include Jim Gibbs, who has joined us all the way from New Zealand, and Mark Jones, our very own UK fodder beet expert. Jim, thank you for joining us today on a typical wet English day. Can you give us a bit of a background to yourself and the work that you're involved with?
Thank you, Katie. I work in New Zealand, and I've for many years worked and developed the fodder beet systems that are used in grazing today. My background is that I worked in veterinary practice for many years and academia in ruminant nutrition and systems developed for many years.
Excellent. Thanks, Jim. I'm now going to come to Mark Jones. Mark, could you just introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, thanks, Katie. Mark Jones, based in Welshpool in Mid Wales. And basically, I offer independent advice in terms of grassland consultancy and forage and outwintering. And then as well as that, we're also farming at home. We've got about 800 head of dairy beef, about 700 sheep all in the rotational grazing system, and all out wintering on fodder beet really. So it's good to have that mix of practical side to it as well.
Brilliant. So we have just completed today the second of a series of fodder beet events taking place across the country. Jim, could you give us an update or sort of a background on how fodder beet's used in the New Zealand systems?
Yes. Well, many of the audience would be familiar with fodder beet, and it's been around in the UK livestock industries for many, many years. It's important to note that the New Zealand use of fodder beet differs greatly from what most UK farming folk are used to. About 15 years ago, fodder beet began to be used in New Zealand as a primary diet, as a direct grazed crop. So in this, it differed that it was strip grazed in the field, and it constituted nearly all of the diet, with a small amount of additional roughage, something as pasture or silage or hay, making up the whole of the diet. So this is a fairly significant departure from the way that it had previously been used in Britain. Now, with that background, there's a couple of important components of fodder beet use that need to be discussed. The first of these is that when we're looking at that crop, if it's going to constitute the primary diet, then the balance of protein and energy in that crop becomes more important. Because we're not mixing diets, and because we're adding very little in terms of additional components to this diet, we have to be much more careful that the leaf in the crop that we're grazing is very well grown, because that leaf will supply nearly all of the protein. The bulb supplies most of the energy because it has a very high sugar content and it's very digestible. So in effect, when we're looking at this crop, we're really looking at two separate crops. Now, there are some significant misunderstandings around that. And one of the difficulties with using this as a livestock system is that without very good leaf on that crop, it becomes very difficult to graze it effectively. What this practically means is that there are some agronomy changes that are required from the traditional sugar beet agronomy, because we have to move our systems to make sure that we've got a lot more leaf in that system. The second component that needs to be understood really carefully with this approach to beet is that because it constitutes the majority of the diet, we have to be much more careful with introduction to that diet. We call that introduction to our dominant fodder beet diet transition. And the reason for this is because it's very high in sugar, as a consequence, we have to adapt them slowly over a period of time so that they get used to that diet.
So we've had a lot of questions today from the audience about the transitioning period and how that differs from cattle and sheep. So what do you consider a good or positive transition for an animal?
There's a couple of very important components in transition in cattle that are not well represented in the information that's commonly available. And the first of these is that beet not only has a lot of sugar in that diet, but it also has a lot of water. And part of the adaptation of that animal to a diet where it's eating as much of this as it can, and that's what we wish it to do in a productive diet, is that we have to account for both of them. So the transition to beet, number one, is letting the rumen microbes adapt to a very high sugar diet, letting the whole of the rumen adapt to a very high water content in that diet. And third and most importantly, we're really teaching those animals over that transition period to eat this responsibly themselves. So if you like, we're changing their head. In cattle, this is very important because if it's not done effectively and if it's not done with some care, there are significant animal health issues and nobody wants that. Now, sheep are very different. They regulate their intake differently and they are much more careful about slowly adapting themselves to these diets. And so in general terms, sheep don't really have a transition period, or at least not one that we have to manage. They'll manage that themselves over a period of a couple of weeks. That's not true with cattle. So effective transition with adult cattle is that we start with about 2 kilograms of dry matter. And to give people who are not familiar with the crop some idea of that, in a well-grown crop, that represents approximately 1 meter square. So it's not a lot of material to begin with, it's a small amount. And that presents some logistical challenges. And we start with that 2 kilograms of dry matter on day one, and there'll be other components of that diet to fill up to make a whole diet. So for example, we'll also be feeding them pasture or silage to make up a full diet. But once we're convinced that all the animals in that group are eating that full 2 kilos, we then begin to increase that 1 kilogram every second day. And that process then takes about 2 weeks or so before they reach their maximum diet. And at that point, they'll be eating as much beet as they can eat, and they'll have approximately 2 kilograms of dry matter of some form of roughage. Might be pasture, might be silage, might be hay. Now in younger animals, that transition is very similar in process, but the actual amounts are halved. So for example, in feeding weaners on that system, starting at about 250 kilogram live weights, they would start on 1 kilogram and then they would move up about 1 kilogram every second day or less. And there's a similar time frame then for them to achieve that full transition.
In regards to Vetimed, how do farmers prepare for and set themselves up for the best performance while grazing the crop?
There are two quite specific animal health issues that can arise with the use of beet as a primary diet. And the first and arguably most important of these is one we've already discussed, which is rumen acidosis. And rumen acidosis occurs if the animals are given too much beet too soon. Note, it's not that they're given too much beet, because in the end they can eat as much of that as they wish on a completely ad libitum diet. But if they're given too much of that beet too soon, it can provoke a very serious condition, which we term rumen acidosis, which will then often lead to significant mortalities. The simple management program that we spoke about before can mitigate rumen acidosis, and well-managed herds show none of this at all. Another significant animal health issue that has to be managed quite carefully, which is related in beet to rumen acidosis, is the deaths by clostridial infection. One of the aspects of beet grazing behind a wire in the paddock is that there's a reasonable soil consumption. This is quite common in a lot of winter crop. But if you marry up that soil consumption with a very high water diet, and particularly one that contains a lot of sugar, then you can wash some of those soil-borne spores into the small intestine, and they sporulate in the presence of those sugars. Therefore, those clostridial bacteria are activated, produce these exotoxins, and you can have this disease. What people practically see with these is about 3 weeks or so into that program, well past the time when they're transitioned. At the time when they're up to maximum intakes, these animals are found dead. There's usually no clinical signs before that, they're just sudden death. And the mitigation for this and the prevention and management is all around very effective vaccinations. So it's an inexpensive vaccine, but all of the young animals in particular should make sure that they've had a full vaccination program before they go on the crop.
Brilliant. Thank you, Jim. So there are some really important environmental aspects as well to consider with this crop. Mark Jones, do you want to take us through some of the soil protection steps or management practices we should be putting in place when grazing such a crop?
Yeah, well, I suppose that the main priority really is to prevent soil runoff from those fields. So really, we've got to be thinking about what fields we're aiming to outwinter on to start with. So if you're in a particularly wet area of the country, we would probably suggest fodder beet isn't for you to start with. That would be the same for very heavy soils, clay soils as well. So we're looking for fairly light ground in low rainfall areas. After that, really, we're looking to prioritise steepness of slope. Ideally, we're wanting the fodder beet on the flatter areas or the flatter ground. And really, if we have got some steep ground we're doing it on, we'd suggest possibly grazing those last in the season. So you're grazing nearer February and March when the soils are drier, and then you've got less possibility of any soil runoff. On top of that, we're going to be aiming to create a grass buffer strip around the edges of the field, so that could be 10 meters in all the way around the field to stop that runoff. And then after that, we're then looking to utilize electric fences, so probably once a week we could back fence those livestock to prevent any further poaching of fields. We can also utilize temporary water, so we can drag a water trough along with us. So again, that's stopping those cattle track back and forth across the whole length of the field. And then finally, it's being about as flexible as we can. So if you know you're going to get a big shower, you can see 40 or 50 mil of rain coming, perhaps you could use a grass field as a run back. So potentially that field could be used as a sacrifice field. It could be going to fodder beet next year, and it could be used just to run back those cattle for that day. And then the stock could be put back on the field. Another possible option we are also looking into is the use of other crops. You could go on with a slug pelleter, add a little bit of forage rye, flick that on to germinate, and then you've got some living roots coming back behind the cattle if it's back fenced. So just being as sensible as we can and looking at different options to retain that soil and nutrients on the field.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. So something that more and more arable farmers are looking at, especially in terms of regen farming, is introducing livestock stock back into arable systems. Can you give us an overview of how farmers can approach this and what options there are for them?
Yeah, well, I suppose in England, they're quite lucky with the stewardship schemes that there's an option called GS4. Farmers will get up to £370 a hectare every year for 5 years. For putting in herbal lays. There are some restrictions in terms of grazing periods on it, but it's a good stepping stone to get that in the overall rotation. So I would suggest if you haven't got grass lays in your arable rotation, this is a good way of getting some of those herbal lays in and paying initially for that cost. I think there's some fencing costs and water costs associated with the grants as well. And then from there, we'd be looking at having a certain acreage or hectareage of grass and herbal lays. And then we'd be looking at the fodder beet for that winter period. So I suppose we've got two genuine systems. We've got more your spring born animals and your autumn born animals. So with the autumn, obviously, if they were dairy beef, for instance, they would come onto the farm either for rearing calves through that first winter or weanlings in early spring. They'd probably spend a couple of months in a shed before being turned out the middle of March. They'd rotationally graze those herbal lays through the summer, followed by wintering out on fodder beet as yearling cattle. And then they'd be finished off those herbal lays at 22 to 24 months the following season. The other option is with the spring calvers. So obviously they would have been calf reared in early spring, turned out to grass. They'd have the first winter on fodder beet, nearer 200 kilos in terms of live weight. Then they'd go through that first winter on fodder beet, turn back to grass, and then they would be then finished off fodder beet that following winter, so they'd have two seasons on fodder beet. If it did overlap or those cattle needed to be cleaned up a little bit, they could have a few weeks of grass in early spring just to finish it. So that would be the kind of systems you'd be aiming for. Hopefully those hobelays would integrate into that system. And as we mentioned, that system works exactly the same if they were suckler cows, autumn born or spring. And then you've also got the potential of bringing in a lot of dairy beef animals under contract, under different kind of schemes, whether you own them as a farmer, whether that can be financed or even owned outright by the abattoir. So it doesn't have to be a capital heavy element to the system.
Jim, is there any recent research on soil carbon inputs when using fodder beet systems or grazing fodder beet systems?
Yes, some of the recent research in soil carbon inputs has looked at what value very large crops being grazed in situ has. And put simply, if we look at a high digestible crop like fodder beet, approximately 15 or 20% of the feed that's eaten by the animals is deposited back onto the surface. The rest of it is kept in their bodies, but that 15 or 20% is deposited back onto the surface of the soils. Now, as a fecal slurry input, if you've got crops that have a very high yield, and fodder beet is comfortably the highest yield of any forage crop that we can use and graze, then that means that you've got a very high stocking rate. So you've got a lot of that material being returned. On a practical level, if we look at that as a 30 ton dry matter crop being grazed, that means approximately 6 tons of that will be returned onto the surface. In addition to that, root crops such as fodder beet have very deep roots that reach down almost 3 meters. The weight of these in some recent research has been calculated using some tube experiments, and it's approximately 2.5 tons. In addition to that as well, most plants will exude a carbon rich and nitrogen poor material from their roots, and they do this in proportion to the biomass above the ground. So the higher the biomass above the ground, the more of this exudate there is. So there's three different ways that very large crops that are grazed contribute quite a lot of carbon back to the soil. So for soils that are challenged by long-term losses of carbon, this can be a very effective way to put a lot of carbon back in a relatively short time.
So I'll draw it to a close there, but thank you both very much.
A very interesting discussion, and hopefully some really useful advice for you to take away and help with next year's management plans. If you want to find out more about grazing fodder beet on your farm system, then there are some useful resources online at ahdb.org.uk. The links will be in the podcast show notes. And thank you again to my guests, Jim Gibbs and Mark Jones. I'm Katie Evans, and thank you for listening.